Hi there, everyone. Today we have another bonus interview episode. It's been a while, and I'm speaking to Matthew Yeagle, an adjunct instructor in history at St. Xavier University and at the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at Northern Illinois University. Matthew's been studying Cambodian history for many years and has recently released a great book about an influential character in modern Cambodian history, someone we've talked about a fair bit on the podcast, Son Ngoc Thanh. Thanh is one of those persons who I wouldn't say people really get much of a look at if they are just focusing their interest in Cambodian history within this scope of genocide studies. Like, for instance, by the beginning of the Khmer Rouge period, he's not really a participant in the story anymore. But as soon as you start looking back, you see his name again and again and again as you sort of realize just how much of an impact he's had on so much of the story that does precede the revolutionary era. So Matthew's book is a great addition to the literature because up until now, and as you'll hear in the interview, there wasn't something dedicated to just Thanh's story and influence, but rather only mentioning him as a kind of supporting character in this story of 20th century Cambodian politics. And Matthew and I had a great chat. He's a fun guy with his own podcast about Vietnam War films. And here we got to speak about Cambodian nationalism, the role of Japan in Thanh's story, the tough relationship that he had with Sihanouk. We explore the role of the Khmer Sarai and how much the CIA is involved in the background here, as well as the difficulties associated with writing this kind of history where many of the puzzle pieces are quite hard to find. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this bonus interview episode, and I'll put links to Matthew's work within the show description. One quick side note as well, with most of the interviews I do conduct, I have a little bit more of a relaxed attitude to background sound and noises and a little bit less control over that too. So apologies if you can hear the odd siren or car. But aside from that, thank you everyone, and I hope you enjoy this chat. I'm here with Matthew Yeagle. How's it going, Matthew?
Doing very well. Very glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Not a problem. My pleasure. Now, you've written this book, Khmer Nationalist, Son Ngoc Thanh, the CIA and the Transformation of Cambodia. It's a great book, fascinating look at this character in modern Cambodian history that, if you've read any books about modern Cambodian history, you'll have no doubt seen his name come up quite a bit. But as important as he is to that story, I've certainly gotten the sense that he is almost this forgotten influence in comparison to some of the other, let's say, large figures in this time. So first, Matthew, great to have you here. Why don't you introduce yourself and how you've gotten into Cambodian history and why you've written this book, man?
Sure, thanks. Thanks very much. How did I get into Cambodian history? Well, I think it starts as a graduate student at Northern Illinois University in history. When I was kind of in the peak of my grad school years, a quite robust team of Cambodian experts there, and the gentleman who became the chair of my dissertation committee, Kenton Clymer, is the author of a 2-book series on U.S. relations with Cambodia. True Jacobson, another historian there that does work on Cambodia, Judy Ledgerwood, Kyung Un. We have the language instruction. I got to shout out Kyung Leung for some help with that. So there's a really good sort of base. And I mean, I gotta think, you know, in the U.S., it's one of the top places to do anything Cambodia related. So I think that's it. I knew I wanted to do something from this era, this period of time, this sort of, you know, kind of United States, Vietnam era. I was interested in that. I was raised by hippies who kind of came of age during that period of time. And so that was sort of a Yeah, you know, it's just kind of, you know, a bit of background, you know, the music, the films, whatever, was just sort of always a thing in my, you know, formative years. And so as I'm trying to figure out what I want to do, Cambodia, relatively speaking, understudied in terms of Southeast Asia and US relations with Cambodia. And so let's see if I can kind of figure out a direction to go that's kind of going to incorporate all those sort of things. So I think that's how I got interested in this track. And like you said, you know, the name Sunyuk Tan, you know, he comes up, you know, sort of peppered here and there in Chandler's stuff or you know, Ken Clymer's stuff, but there's not a like robust examination of him. And I'm not sure I got one, but I tried to. So and we could probably get into some of the reasons why maybe it's not robust, but yeah, so that's kind of what I was thinking. It's this name. He seems like he's worked with the U.S. intelligence, maybe. What is that story? So I kind of wanted to examine that in greater detail. So, yeah.
Fantastic. All right, well, and we're here to talk about the man. We're talking about Son Yat-Tan, and this book you've titled Khmer Nationalist. Now, listeners to this show will have become familiar with this character throughout the series. We've touched on his influence sort of waned and been quite effective at some points. But why don't you give us a little insight into the earlier days, this kind of cultural stew in which he was brought up in? And how do you think about Cambodia around the start of the 20th century? And how do you relate Son Yat-Tan to this idea of Cambodian nationalism?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I will shout out Elizabeth Becker's Cambosh, who does a really good job on a lot of this era, kind of leading up to when does her book finish? 1940, maybe. So she has a lot of really good stuff. So that would be another direction for this kind of earlier era that I would suggest people check out. But yeah, where does he fit in? I mean, he is. Boy, you know, he is a little 1908. He's born in Cochin, China, and he to a split Khmer father, Sino-Vietnamese mother, and so. But seeing, you know, he's born in this era, which is going to be a thing later in, you know, big in the Khmer Rouge era, reclaiming kind of the southern Vietnam, kind of this part of the greater Angkorian Empire. He's born in that area. He sees himself as Khmer, right? Born in Vietnam, spends a ton of his life in southern Vietnam. So it's always a part of it, always a part of him. But he's very becomes very adamant about nationalism over, I guess, kind of breaking free of the French. You know, this is kind of a takes long period of time for it to sort of form. But you know, he studies there in France. He in the 30s he starts the nationalist newspaper Nagarvata, which, you know, is probably the earliest of the early sort of speaking out about Khmer nationalism, kind of using kind of Buddhism as sort of a vehicle to maybe kind of transport Cambodia from this from the sort of protectorate status toward an independent status and reclaiming some form of agency for Khmer and Khmer people in Cambodia. So he's in Cambodia at that time working at the paper. And I think it's something that develops over time. I think over time he becomes a bit more militant with it. So by the time you're kind of getting toward World War II, it's more focused on that sort of message. And so, you know, he is kind of attempting to sort of recruit monks who will then be, I don't know, to using the term foot soldiers, probably not completely accurate or correct, but in a way, foot soldiers to then recruit for this sort of, I guess, idea that he has. So I think he envisions something like that, you know, in the 30s, he's attempting to kind of plant the seeds to act on it.
Yeah, particularly through that is it the Higher Pali Institute? It's this, or is it just the Cambodian Buddhist Institute? I can't remember.
Yeah, the
exactly.
Buddhist Institute, right? Right, there's another one. He's sort of the French kind of remove him for a period of time, and he's kind of goes to this sort of Sithawat school, and he is, attempting to do some things there as well. But right, yeah, it's through the Buddhist Institute, which is located in Phnom Penh, which is actually created by the French, headed up by a French woman, Suzanne Carpelez. But yeah, it's sort of through that French creation, it sort of turns turns against its creator in some ways, right? Frankenstein's monster. Zinnemann's really, really great Colonial Bastille is it's different circumstances, obviously, but it discusses French colonial prisons and how they became sort of this petri dish for sort of creating Vietnamese nationalists against the French.
Yeah, certainly. I remember when we were touching on that, and listeners might recall too. Is it Popolo Condor, the island prison where you get? It's one of the guys that's really close to Tan from the start. His name escapes me just at the moment, but he's sent there mixing.
It's Patch Chuan, I
That's
think.
the yeah. So he's sort of like partner in sort of crime, as it were. But yeah, it's very interesting to see the. When you peel off some of the layers there, and especially for, I guess I could use the word lay person in a few different ways there, but certainly maybe from your typical sort of Western centric point of view, you do have this general idea of Buddhism as a very sort of peaceful and contemplative spirituality. And then when you see how intrinsic it is to I believe like many countries in Southeast Asia, people will have comments like this, but certainly one I've come across in Cambodia is something along the lines of to be Cambodian is to be Buddhist, where it's intrinsically linked to the sort of national identity there. It's very interesting for me to see how he leveraged that idea. But you did touch on the French there, and then second to that, into the Second World War, where Imperial Japan really acts as another sort of real catalyst for change here. I think this is around about the time that you'll see Son Yat-sen getting around Phnom Penh in quite militaristic attire. How do you assess Tan's relationship with the Japanese over the course of the Second World War, and how do you sort of reflect on that relationship?
I think it is one that both sides use the other, in a way that they thought it would be beneficial to them or their more broad goals. So for Sun Yat-sen, supporting the Japanese against the French or having Japanese backing would be a buffer against maybe a return from potential. France, coming back, reasserting power, right? Vichy is, theoretically in control, but I think it's using that. He's not, 100%, I don't think, bought into this, greater, East Asian co-prosperity sphere, Asia for Asians. Sure, Japan's going to be at the front of that, of course, but like it's, all everybody, all Asians unite. I'm not sure he's, he doesn't go to, the conference that some other prominent Southeast Asians go to. He's not there. He stays sort of stashed away in Japan. Post that umbrella demonstration, he kind of hides out in Bangkok briefly, and then he's whisked away to Japan, where he kind of lives under a pseudonym. He, has some correspondence back and forth to supporters and followers in Cambodia. But I think there he's kind of just waiting for the right time. Japan sort of brings him back. He's made Minister of Foreign Affairs and then elevated to Prime Minister. And I think he's kind of co-serving in both those roles briefly. So yeah, he's serving as Prime Minister for a little while, not too long, a couple months. But that is. For him, I think he wants to, this is kind of after the war in Europe is over, when he's prime minister. And I'm not, it's hard to know, like, what kind of reports is Sun Yat-sen or is just an average Cambodian getting about the war in the Pacific? Like, you know, it's a little hard to know day to day how up to date they are on what's going on, but you have to figure that they know that the writing is kind of on the wall for Japan. So he attempts to kind of, I say, solidify his position, and he would argue Cambodian independent position. Ho Chi Minh does the same, you know, in September 45 in Vietnam. Sun Yat-sen is trying to do that also. But yeah, he has a lot of contacts with Japan during his time as prime minister, and they are, you know, some of them are discussed in the book. But it is, yeah, it's an interesting, it doesn't ever seem like super secure period for him. And I, you know, I think the writing is kind of on the wall. Once the Allies come back, you know, he is kind of swiftly arrested and whisked away to France for six years or so. And so, yeah, it's fleeting power. You don't really get a great sense of, like, man, what kind of leader would he have been if, because, you know, it's just for so brief. And so, you know, it's, some of the things that are discussed are always trying to secure energy sources, you know, like make sure the electrical is guarded or whatever, you know, and things like that. And there is some discussion on what do we do if the Allies come back, France comes back, you know, what kind of, you know, things like that. But it's hard to get a sense of, like, where would things have gone? I think it's really hard to say if he had stayed in power. But yeah, so then he's whisked away to France under house arrest, which I don't believe was too egregious or anything from my understanding. Yeah, he's out of the picture. Sihanouk is formally back in the picture, I guess, for the next 30 years or 20 plus years. Yeah, so.
And I'm wondering, this, as I recall, we do have quite a bit of Tan's letters from this time while he was in Japan, and presumably as well, this is where he does quite a bit of reflecting during his time in house arrest in France as well. It's where listeners will recall, you know, various sort of Marxist intrigued individuals will sort of make a pilgrimage to go and see Tan as this sort of figure in Cambodian politics they had some access to anyway. Some are more disappointed with him than others. But for you, as a someone writing this book about him, was this period particularly fertile for resources about him?
No era was fertile, I would say. No. I would say none of it was fertile for resources. yeah, that was one of the interesting things. I had no idea going into it, like, what to expect. I had an idea of what I hoped to tell. I wanted to talk about U.S. foreign policy, foreign relations, Cambodia during this period of time, and kind of discuss and look at Sun Yat-sen as kind of a way to analyze that. That's what I set out to do. That's what the book hopefully does. Now, what I had no expectations on sources going into it, what I would or would not find. And it was tough. It was tough in Cambodia. It was tough, you know, in various spots in Cambodia, a lot of different places. Tough in the U.S., different archives, presidential libraries and everything. So yeah, it was hard. But so I think I've liked to think about it is it's one of those, like, 1,000-piece puzzles that you're trying to put together, but it's also missing like 780 of the pieces, and you still, like, need to attempt to put it together. It's like doing that kind of puzzle was sort of doing the research. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It was hard. But
what do they say? Start with the corners.
Are the corners even there, though? Do you even have the corners?
Yeah, that's
right?
Sort of. So, didn't even get the corners.
Yeah, it was tough. So no, I would not say fertile. But even if we don't know specifically what he is doing, we know in Cambodia the Democratic Party is becoming more powerful. They are kind of in Cambodia, big followers, supporters of him, his message. So you can use things like that to kind of continue the story. I've been in the summer, I like to kind of pick up fun reading. And for me, it's, of course, always going to be something history. But it's I started Stephen Kotkin's, the first of a 3-part series. The third one hasn't been released yet, on Stalin. And I'm noticing some similarities in the very early years of Stalin, where there's not much on what's Stalin actually doing, but it is a lot on what the heck is going on in Russia in that time. So, maybe there's some similarities there. But I did think, I hope I filled in a lot of gaps that were otherwise missing on Sun Yat-sen. Tough going.
For sure. Yeah, no, I just, as I was reading it, I was like, I think that, yeah, he may have been hoping that there was just a little something, some letter that he wished he'd had to just say, what was he thinking of it?
There were a few really, like the magic, like the U.S. intercepted of Japanese communications during the war actually mentioned him in a few different instances. So that was a cool find. Coming up later in the 50s, there's a really, really, really good find I had, so which I think we can probably get to. But, there's still plenty of cool stuff found. It's just, you just don't know when you start it, right? It's part of the journey.
Well, you've sort of, story-wise, we've sort of got up to his time in France, post-independence. And listeners might recall that Tan has this big return to Cambodia, this triumphant return after his exile in France after the war there. Now, he quickly sort of, after doing a couple of, he makes a few appearances here and there, starts another newspaper, as he loves to do. And he then quickly just jumps ship. He begins his own sort of tangent of the Issarak movement, his own sort of personal brand of that. And, I mean, aside from that, there was that sort of half coup against the Sihanouk family earlier in the story. And then there's this sort of almost personal rebuff to Sihanouk while the French Indochina War is still going on. But even though there's all these events that sour this relationship with Sihanouk, I'm wondering how you came to think about this dynamic between the then king and this, well, he was the first prime minister, as you just mentioned. Do you think that this was always doomed to antagonism, or is there some sort of other reality where you could have seen them work together and perhaps avoided some of the issues that Cambodia was about to have?
Yeah. I think it would be difficult. I think they are both very, very, very strong-willed, in some ways narcissistic, egocentric guys. Sihanouk has some success, I think, backing up that as during his time in office, which is a very long time. Sun Yat-sen, I think some of his are maybe more, aspirational. Dreams, I think the things he envisioned are for himself were hard to see be realized. It would be hard to see, him come to power, in the 50s or something like that. It seems pretty implausible. He has backing, he has some popular support, some followers, and I think he's important in the process of Cambodia actually getting its independence, and in Sihanouk finally pushing France hard for, you know, first kind of political concessions and then independence in late 53. He, in a lot of ways, Sihanouk is following Sun Yat-sen's lead. And I argue in the book that Sihanouk is attempting to kind of co-opt some of the political popularity that Sun Yat-sen has on that front, independence front, by sort of following the path that Sun Yat-sen has already laid. You know, he is agitating for independence well ahead of the time Sihanouk is. Sihanouk is much closer, the monarchical family is closer to sort of French officials and things like that. So it takes Sihanouk a while to get on board. But, you know, once he does get on board, you know, there's some token gestures of outreach. Sun Yat-sen does actually credit Sihanouk and says, like, you know, to paraphrase, hey, heck of a job, buddy. Well done. Way to go. And so I don't know. Maybe there's a fleeting moment. I think maybe post that, you know, end of 53 into 54, maybe there could have been some kind of meeting of the minds coming together. But I think they both have different visions on how they want the government to be structured and things of that nature as well. So I think that would have made it really tough.
Particularly as, yeah, after that relationship breaks down and we do have this Khmer Sarai movement, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that roughly translate to Free Khmer.
Free Khmer, yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of militant anti-government group led by Tan, operating at various times out of sort of the border with Thailand and in South Vietnam as well. And this becomes quite an annoying thorn in Sihanouk's side throughout much of the time, well, pretty much the entire time he's in power, even in the golden years, as it were. Now, tell me, who really are the Khmer Sarai? What is this group? Just how much help were they getting from the outside? And I guess how right was Sihanouk about them? What was this impression that he had of the group, how much did that actually converge with reality? Or was this a boogeyman to him, like so many other things were, born out of this sort of paranoia rather than reality?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, a fun one too. Let me start with who they are. So they are predominantly based where Sun Yat-sen is from. And so the former Cochin China, South Vietnam, ethnic Khmer in South Vietnam. The numbers vary, the estimates of numbers vary and how many there are at different times. It's never super significant number wise. You know, it's in the thousands, 5,000 maybe more. But it's never a massive, massive force. But yeah, they are annoying to Sihanouk. I would equate it to annoyance more than anything else. But for him, they're important for a couple of reasons. One is, it is a way. You said boogeyman, I think, right? It is something that he can kind of galvanize internal support against. Hey, these Khmer Sarai, there's a border raid, they've crossed the border, they're attacking, which is something that would happen. You know, these little kind of pop-in, pop-outs from South Vietnam or from Thailand. You know, small skirmishes, things like that. So, hey, we've captured four, we're going to parade them in front of, you know, everybody or whatever. Five have defected and they've come to lay, you know, to bow down to me and say their grand apologies or whatever. And so these things would be like big in the press and things like this. So you would see things like that fairly commonly in Cambodia. Where it's a bigger issue is in terms of, I guess, regional relations, more broad Cold War relations, because Sihanouk sort of fashions himself as a neutralist. I would maybe say a left-leaning neutralist. His neighbor to the southeast is not. His neighbor to the west is not. And the United States is not. And so in this Cold War hysteric era, a group like the Khmer Sarai, maybe them, their followers, maybe they could be useful tools to perhaps get rid of Sihanouk. And so there is an attempt in 58 into 59 to do that, which is the Dap Chuan affair, if you will. And so I talk about that in the book, because Sun Yat-tan, from all reports, not, I guess I shouldn't say all reports, from most reports, is an instrumental figure in sort of the planning of that. Khmer Sarai soldiers are supposed to come to aid Dap Chuan, who's the governor of Siem Reap province, who's going to instigate this overthrow of Sihanouk. That's the theory behind it. He's got the backing of South Vietnam. He's got the backing of Thailand. And he has the backing of the United States. Sihanouk, after this, Sihanouk, he must have very good internal, like, intelligence sources, because he sniffs this out and puts it down before it's ever able to come up. But he captures a ton of evidence, talks about his evidence for that. It's in his memoirs. And what he reports in his memoirs is, I think, pretty accurate. It's a CIA operator there. There is evidence of, there's gold shipped in from South Vietnam. That Ngo Dinh Diu is kind of the main point person in South Vietnam to support these sort of initiatives in Cambodia. So yeah, it's a real thing. I mean, flashing forward a couple of years to Kennedy, the Kennedy administration, he's talking to his national security advisor, Roger Hilsman. This is actually November 20th, 1963. So it's 2 days before his assassination. And Sihanouk has been complaining about, at that point, he had cut off military aid from the United States. And Kennedy's just kind of befuddled. He's like, Sihanouk, he keeps talking about these, like, radio transmits from these Khmer Sarai people. Like, what the hell is he talking about? What is that? And Roger Hilsman's like, well, yeah, it's true. The CIA did support him during the Eisenhower administration. We did provide support to attempt to overthrow him. And so that was one of those, like, oh, sweet, you know, things when I found that one. So yeah, I found that document in like 2010. And the audio is actually, if you look at the, well, you can look at the footnote in the book, but at the Miller Center, has the audio of that conversation. So you can listen to that actual audio. That's one of the, you know, Kennedy's taping system was not nearly, sadly, as robust as Richard Nixon's, but there are some Kennedy tapes that is actually one of the ones that is there. So that's a really cool one. Yeah, so an attempted coup, Thailand, South Vietnam, United States, all combined with the help of Sun Yat-tan.
This isn't really on the running order here, but I'm wondering how just this idea of the CIA as this not quite under control of a, funnily enough, a central sort of agency, like it seems almost compartmentalized in this way where people were given the remit to just sow discord and plan a little coup here and there without, yeah, as you say, a president knowing about that. Although you do mention in the book how Eisenhower is fairly clear about wanting some change in Cambodia. But yeah, how did this study inform your idea of how the CIA was operating at this time?
Yeah, I think it changes. It's different under different administrations. Eisenhower is very much into using kind of clandestine intelligence as opposed to, you know, grand, you know, armies and things like that. You know, former five-star, I guess you don't lose the five-star, right? You retain it even as president. So I guess he wasn't former. General, of course, in World War II. And so I think to him, he saw a lot of the, took the lesson he learned in World War II is that these large scale things, no good can come of that. So let's attempt to do things. It'll be cheaper, it'll be easier, and so you see, you know, Guatemala, you see Iran, you see attempt in Cambodia, things like that. So yeah, I think, you know, in Kennedy's case, it's not quite like that, you know, an attempt at the Bay of Pigs, but it's not like Kennedy didn't know, even though that's an Eisenhower designed, and the plan comes from Nixon under the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy wasn't in the dark about any of that, but there are things that, like you're saying, yeah, you know, maybe it has a little bit of a mind of its own in some instances. I think there's certainly something to that. And those are always harder sources to comb. So they actually, some of the CIA stuff is searchable now online. A lot of it, you know, getting into that CREST database, you know, I remember going to the, you know, a decade ago or something at the archives in College Park, you have to actually, there's one computer in one room that you're allowed to use, and you can't, there's, you know, you can print stuff from it, but that's it. And so it's still hard to get a lot of the CIA stuff, documents and things like that, that you would like to otherwise have. But
I just rewatched the original Mission Impossible the other day, where he has to go, like that classic scene where he has to go down and stop the room. Yeah. But I'd sort of forgotten the whole reason he's in there. It's just there's just one computer that has all the stuff. And it just sounds like you were describing that exact thing.
It was a little similar. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Towards the end of the book, you discuss what is one of the bigger questions about sort of the Vietnam War's spread, which is this coup of Sihanouk. And you give a pretty good breakdown for me on the various sides of people who say it was either no CIA involvement, no American involvement, they knew about it, or those that that think that there was a bit more than just a tacit sort of knowledge of what was going to happen. Do you mind just going over that a little bit for me here as well, for the listeners, just to give us a bit of a breakdown on what you think happened there?
Right. So unlike the Dap Chuan attempt in 58 to 59, there's no smoking gun, I guess, if you will, in terms of finding sources to 100% corroborate. But we have a lot of good, you know, circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial, I don't think necessarily has to have a bad connotation. There's a lot of good little peaks. Going back to, gosh, when was that book published? Seymour Hersh in his earlier iteration before becoming a complete Putin stooge as he is today, had some good sources on that. And so kind of using some of those as a jumping block, I was actually able to find some of those papers that he references and some of the interviews that were done with some U.S. They would have been army and intelligence operators operating in South Vietnam, talking about kind of some of the preliminary buildup and things like that to the coup. Sun Yuk-tan himself says, yeah. Yeah, the U.S., they helped us out. I don't know if I would 100% take everything he says at face value, but he that's another, you know, it's a good primary source to corroborate. There are lots of, to make a long story short, there are lots of small pieces to fit together to paint a pretty good picture that the United States is, at very minimum, knows there's about to be, this is about to happen. And there is a lot of good evidence that the United States provided kind of logistical and backing support for the events of March of 70. So I think there's pretty good evidence that Trojan horse theory of defecting Khmer Sarai, hey, we apologize, Sihanouk, we're going to come back, and they get placed in the Cambodian military to be ready for when this happens. I think there's some good evidence for that as well that I kind of go through in the book. So, I mean, as H.R. Haldeman said in his memoirs, the overthrow of Sihanouk, replacing him with Lon Nol, was all right with us, as in the Nixon administration. Sadly, Nixon was not taping in 1970. Really wish he was. But yeah, it is, there is good info for it. There's a lot to it. So yeah, the book attempts to kind of capture where is the consensus in the historiography in some ways, and then attempts to add more to that as well. So it's not a 100% clear picture, but I think it's my book makes it, I hope, a little bit less fuzzy than it was prior.
Well, I can say personally, you swayed me from where I was to closer to where you are. Yeah, for sure. I found it very compelling. Now, I did have a question here generally about the sort of historiography and the lack of sources and how much of a pain that must have been. But I feel like we did sort of touch that a bit earlier.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, perhaps we can sort of, I can hand you this in two ways. I was wondering if you wanted to add anything else to that over the sort of course of your work on Tarn and any reflections you might have on that and sort of piggyback on from that to what do you make of Tarn's legacy in this modern Cambodian historical story as well? And perhaps we can just sort of wrap that up from there, mate.
Well, in terms of the research, you know, I talked about not knowing what to expect really going in. And I think that makes it, as somebody doing research, historian, that's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it exciting. That's what, you know, you read like that Kennedy Hillsman transcript at the JFK library, you know, and you start to get a little bit of goosebumps like, whoa, 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 this is a big deal. And so, you know, that's why you're in the game, right? That's why you do it. It's one of the reasons is for those moments. They're fun. So yeah, it can be a little bit frustrating, a little bit, you know, at times like, man, where is this going to go? Is this a thing? Do I actually have a book here? Like, well, the publisher says I do, so I guess I have to finish it. And I'm on a timeline, so I better get it going. So yeah, you know, it's a fun, hard, long process. I mean, I probably started the project in like 2008 or 9. Yeah, and it came out this year, 2023. So that's a long time. So yeah, I've changed. I've grown a lot. I have offspring that have grown a lot in the intervening years as well. And so yeah, it's been a long, long, strange trip, as the Grateful Dead would say. So yeah, it's been fun. Now where is Sihanouk Tan's place in, I guess, kind of modern Cold War era Cambodian history? It's I think it's still a bit of a mysterious one. I think, you know, when he died in 1977 after the fall, spoiler alert for any of your listeners that maybe you're not there yet, but South Vietnam falls in 1975 and he's taken prisoner. He is kind of some of his followers are taken prisoner. And, you know, I was corresponding with his grandson. His daughter, last surviving daughter, passed away and was suffering from some health issues. And she passed away last year. But I was talking to his grandson some, and he supplied a couple photos, which are in the book, which are really, really fabulous. And gave a little bit of a personal familial touch to the story, because that's one of the hard things is like, who's Sihanouk Tan as the guy? Like, what does he do on a Saturday night? Does he, like, you know, is he watching football with the boys and having a beer, like going out for pizza? Like, you know, like what is his thing? You know, that is a tough one to fill. And I don't, you know, it was a hard, hard thing. So as a guy, as a man, like, yeah, it's still a lot there, you know, for somebody to try to dig in and find out. But yeah, he passes away, you know, I think it's a bit sad. He goes on a hunger strike, always has some health issues at the time. And I think he kind of passes away as a bit of a footnote, maybe, you know, maybe in some ways forgotten in Cambodia. You know, Cambodia is being ravaged by the Khmer Rouge at that time. Yeah, I think he's an important figure for a lot of things, though. I think he's an important figure on the role he played in Cambodia's gaining of independence in 1953. And I think he instigates it to happen faster than it otherwise would have. I think he is an important figure for looking at what does the United States think of Southeast Asia during the Cold War. What does the United States think of these so-called neutralist leaders? Whether it's Sihanouk, whether it's Sukarno or Nehru, right? These kind of self-proclaimed neutralists in the Cold War. Pull up the who's the man behind the curtain in terms of that thought. What does the United States really think of these? And so New York Times is a really interesting way of kind of looking at that. And the United States was not super cool with it, let's say. So I think you can learn some about U.S. foreign policy during the period, learn about Cambodian internal political workings, Cambodia's relationship, especially with its neighbors in South Vietnam and with Thailand, are really fraught border issues to this day. When I was at Priya Vihia, it's just peppered with bunkers and guys with machine guns pointing at Thailand. Khmer Sarai raided Priya Vihia in, was it 62? From that same field I was looking on down on, so it's some of the same issues have been going on for a while, but the seeds for some of the modern current issues are sort of sown during this period of time. So yeah, it's a interesting story. And it was great to be in Cambodia for a long time, doing the research and then living there. And yeah, it was a wild ride. In some ways, I'm sad it's over, but God, I'm really glad to not have to write anymore about Sun Yat-sen. Sorry, buddy, my old deceased pal.
No, that's great. No, I agree. I think he's this integral sort of part of the story, and I think your book does a really good job of fleshing that out, because as I said at the beginning there, I do think he has sort of become the forgotten part of that. Not to get all, great man of history kind of thing, but there's about four men that generally get most of the history in Cambodia, if we include Hun Sen.
Yeah.
So no, I think your book's a great exploration of him. And I'm asking readers to go out and get it, because it's good stuff, and just like this podcast is an attempt to try and show that that story doesn't start yesterday, you have to keep going back, then I urge listeners to go out and get this to keep that going. But I'm also increasingly aware of your time today, mate. I don't want to take too much else of it. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or share or do, or like a Twitter handle or social media or anything to do with the publication?
Yeah, well, my home away from home is the podcast Napalm in the Morning, so you can check out at Napalm Podcast on Twitter. That is a podcast that looks at films about the Vietnam War, and we try to be as non-academic as possible on that, but still provide, background historical context, fact checks. We have fun with that one. So please check that out if you're so inclined. My actual Twitter handle is Matthew_Jagel, Jagel. So you can find me there on the white nationalist platform formerly known as Twitter, currently known as X. Who knows how long I'll be able to stomach it, but I'm still there. So yeah, hook me up there. And you can get there's a link to the book with a discount code pinned to my page there if you want to do that, or get it from your local place or wherever.
Amazing. All right. Thank you so much, Matthew. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Great being here.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that chat. I hope that listening to this podcast was also able to give some of you an insight into, what we were discussing there, and hopefully some extra context to Matthew's book if you do decide to go out and get it. If you're still listening here, I will remind you all that it's a great help to me and the show if you can leave a rating or a review on iTunes or Spotify. And if you'd like to support the show more directly, you can make a once-off or recurring payment through PayPal, or you could become a Patreon member for as little as $2 a month. Donating this even one time will give you access to the Killing Fields movie commentary track, And also about a third of all of the contributions that come in are given to the Cambodian Children's Fund as well as Animal Rescue Cambodia monthly. Now, these two organizations are making a genuine positive impact on the conscious suffering of people and animals in Cambodia today. So, very worthwhile. Now, thank you for listening, everyone, and until next time, goodbye.